of Alaska. Open meeting with the recording of Mr. George Preston's early life.
He has requested, and I think it's a suggestion, that in order to know in the future who are present at this meeting, if each one of you will just state your name in a fairly clear voice. Just go right ahead. May we have the reading of the minutes for the last meeting, please?
The regular meeting was held on December 12th at the Society of Health in the Centennial Building, 710, 8 p.m., September 24th, 1960. Vice President Audrey Lawson called the meeting to order. There were 21 members and guests present. The minister read food. Office case report was showed down $320.31 in bank. Committee report. Gary Meade's report was fully recorded, which cost $231.98. Charles Simon, who is the chairman of the magazine, stated he has been very busy since the last 2 months and would have a report today for our next meeting. First, if our president will be back to the next meeting, and that time will appoint a committee. Robert Boone made a motion that the town lady come to travel by to take upon themselves to have a city survey move the Wickerton Memorial from the Chamber of Commerce Building to the University of Alaska. It's sent to the table of Mr. Boone. Motion seconded by Frank Young carried. Mr. Boone suggests that the spire instruct the agents of the university to honor in some way the memory of Honorable Dan Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan was responsible for bringing the license and the month office to Alaska. Mr. Robert Boone was sick of leaving. He gave a very interesting report on the early university. The first discovery was gold in 1902. Mr. Barnett's pretty coat and Dan Wickerton's courthouse and Holly built the first schoolhouse. This speech was recorded on a new recorder. The speech is also recorded on a pioneer recorder.
You heard the reading of the minutes. Are there any omissions or any corrections? If not, the stand approved the address. Are there any committees outstanding? The only one that would be trying. They have a treasurer's report.
The treasurer's report still stands for the last week.
Are there any outstanding committees?
We have not very long time.
No, it's not here, please. And I mentioned in the minutes that I would appoint committees. We'll just have to stand as it is now until I can give that some thought. We'll have to try to have some action between now and the next meeting so that we'll have a report for you at that time. I don't know what now would be just as good a time as any for Mr. Preston to make his talk, if you'd be so kind, George, if you could give us your address now, I think it probably be the best time.
You're
ready
now?
Yes, if you would. I think you can probably get around this way a little better than.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Historical Society, ladies and gentlemen. I might as well tell you right off that I tried my best to get out of this engagement tonight. I didn't make it. About 2 months ago, Audrey Loftus called me on the telephone and asked if I would mind coming out of this society to make a talk. I don't usually talk over the telephone. I don't hear very well. And Mrs. Preston took the phone and she did the communicating. Well, it's very easy to get out and make an excuse and get away with it when you're talking to another person. I did that at that time. And about 10 days later, when I was in the house alone, Audrey called me again. Again, I tried to wiggle out of it, and I made it, too, pretty well. But if I had met Audrey face to face, I don't think I'd have had the heart to turn her down. But anyhow, I thought I had done it successfully again. And unfortunately for me, about 10 days ago, I ran into Florence here in the MC store, and she told me that she wanted me to come here and make my talk. Well, I again tried to put it off and made a half promise that sometime later I would probably be able to oblige them. But she only took that as a real promise that I was. And when she called me a few days later, it was to make the announcement that I was down for tonight. So what could I do? And it so happened that I had a manuscript in my personal file at home, which I prepared about 3 years ago to form the basis for an article, a little sketch, personal sketch, to appear in the MCE magazine, which is published 4 times a year. I had a letter from the young woman who was editor of the magazine, and she asked me to prepare such a sketch. Well, I didn't know just how many words she'd want in it, what length it would be, and I was not quite prepared to write such an article, but I did finally sit down and wrote quite a lengthy essay. I sent that to her and told her that she would have to cut that down to size. I knew it was far too long to appear in that magazine. And she did. She used the main points of the personal autobiographical material, and that was published in the MC Flag, which is the company paper published in Seattle. So I still had that manuscript, and it is mainly historical, of course, but it is that there is also some personal and autobiographical material in it. And under the circumstances, I'll have to ask you to excuse me for inflicting that on you. And if I tire you and don't interest you in any way, why, you can blame Florence. After I got through with my paper, before I sent it to the young lady, I thought I had to title it, so I put Dredgings from the Well of Memory, Some Notes of a Pioneer on Days Long Past, and that is the substance of this paper. So with your permission, I proceed, and it's rather lengthy, so I may tire you. The news of the historic gold strike in the Klondike in 1897 spread quickly throughout the world and was the means of drawing men of adventurous spirit from many countries to brave the dangers and difficulties of the long trail over mountain, lake, and river to reach their promised land. I was then a young fellow of 19 and was employed as a clerk in the office of an engineering works at a manufacturing town 9 miles east of Glasgow, Scotland. Like other people at that time, I read the exciting news appearing in the papers regarding the stampede to the new El Dorado, but not by the greatest stretch of the imagination did I ever see myself as being destined to journey to that fabled land, the Klondike. However, without my seeking it, and with no effort on my part, the way was opened up for me so that I did finally reach Dawson City on one of the first river boats to get through Lake Leverge after the opening of navigation at the end of May 1900. The chairman of the board of the engineering company where I worked was also chairman of the board of 2 Klondike gold companies which were financed in Great Britain, with head offices in London. I was offered the position of mine clerk and bookkeeper for Klondike Government Concession Limited on Hunker Creek, about 14 miles from Dawson. And my engagement for that position was the beginning of my great adventure, the opening chapter of my personal odyssey. The journey to the Klondike commenced at the port of Liverpool as a passenger of the SS Tunisian of the Allan Line and proved to be one long, delightful storybook adventure for me. I can still recall vividly the pleasure and wonderful experiences of that journey so long, long ago. My route took me up the St. Lawrence with a stop at historic Quebec where the steerage passengers debarked. Then on to Montreal, where I got the CPR train to Owen Sound, and from there by lake steamer through Lakes Erie, Huron, and Superior to Fort William, where I again took the train for the balance of the trip to Vancouver. I left Vancouver after a delay of a few days as passenger on the steamship Kutch for Skagway. The ship was loaded to the guards with people and merchandise for the Klondike, and the passengers were a motley and interesting crowd to me. There were several incidental delays on the journey north from Skagway because of the great crowds trying to get to Dawson and the fact that the White Pass Railway was not yet opened all the way to Whitehorse and the ice had not yet cleared out from the head of Lake Leverge. But to make a long story short, we finally got to Dawson after midnight but light as day under the midnight sun. The incidents and experiences of that whole long journey was the most wonderful adventure of my life up to that time, and I still regard it as one of the most memorable episodes in my life. The English companies operating in the Klondike at the beginning of the century were not very successful. The method of mining frozen placer ground was something new to all of them, and this presented many difficulties standing in the way of recovering the gold with a profit. Only the very rich ground could be properly mined by the early methods of sinking shafts and drift mining the pastry by hand labor. That was quite some years before the days of diesel-driven caterpillars and bulldozers and all the modern methods now applied in successful mining. I stayed with the mining business until the fall of 1902 and then went out to Vancouver on one of the late boats near the end of September. I remained in Vancouver until March 1903 and then went north to Valdez on the steamer Genie, steam schooner Genie, from Seattle to join a friend who was going into the new Nazina diggings near the headwaters of the Chittenah River in the vicinity of the newly discovered Kennecott copper mine. This again was a new and entirely novel venture for me, and was really pioneering in a rough, undeveloped, and hazardous country. When mining closed down in the fall of 1903, I returned to Valdez with two companions, men several years older than myself, and we made the journey safely by rowboat down the rivers and crossing the coast mountains at Marshall Pass into Low River Valley, and so into Valdez, the whole journey consuming about a week. I stayed in Valdez for several weeks, undecided what to do, and then with my partner we joined up with two other groups, making nine men of us all together with six dog teams for the overland journey to Fairbanks, as news of the new gold camp reaching us in Valdez gave us confidence that there was a genuine rich and extensive gold strike here. The years that have passed since that time, over 57 years ago, have amply verified that verdict. Our party left Valdez the day after Thanksgiving 1903, and after a long, arduous trip over an unbroken winter trail, we finally pulled into Fairbanks on the evening of January 4th, 1904. At this present time, only three of that original party of nine are still alive. That's what I wrote 3 or 4 years ago, but I'm the sole remaining member of that party now. And I was the youngest of the three. I thought for a while that we had, so to speak, jumped from the frying pan into the fire, because Fairbanks at that date was certainly not much of a town in appearance. In addition to the NC Company store, there was one other small store in First Avenue, east of it. And beyond Cushman Street east, facing the Chena River, there was a range of a few saloons which provided warmth and a place to hang out for men who had nowhere else to go. Then there was a tent restaurant on Cushman between 1st and 2nd Avenue, run by a cheerful and popular colored man, Tom Pierce. And there were a number of assorted buildings up Cushman Street, 3 or 4 blocks, and along 2nd and 3rd Avenue. That was before the days of electric light, which did not come to Fairbanks for another year, and the only lighting for that first winter was provided by kerosene lamps and candles. So by present standards, it could not be said that Fairbanks was a cheerful place at that time. But there was little or no complaint from anyone that I remember, and the hardy pioneers took it all in stride cheerfully as part of the game. For the latter part of that first winter, supplies of all kinds were very short, and a number of men were making long trips by dog teams to other places on the Yukon, Circle, Rampart, Tanana, to get needed food supplies. My partner and I had brought our own supplies from Valdez, and so we made out until the spring, although not very sumptuously. Together we did some prospecting on a small tributary near the head of Fairbanks Creek, 30-odd miles from town. But when the warm days of spring came around in late April, I was out of money and more or less discouraged at the prospect before us, and I came into Fairbanks to look for a job. The famous Judge Wickersham, whom I had been introduced to in Valdez, had come over to Fairbanks to hold a session of court. I called on the judge, and he gave me a letter to Howard Turner, agent of the NC Company in Fairbanks. I was hired to go to work in May, and that is how I got my connection with the company, which made me a permanent resident of Fairbanks until my retirement in November 1947 at age 70. The staff at the time I joined the company consisted of Howard Turner, agent, Jack Healy, storekeeper, Dick Wood, bookkeeper and cashier. So I made the fourth member as assistant storekeeper and delivery man by hand basket. That was the method at that time. The entire stock left at that time was a mere handful of groceries and assorted wares, none of it fresh, and much of it overstocked that had been carried for years by other company stores in the Yukon. and which had been transferred to Fairbanks on company boats the previous season in order to carry the community through until the opening of navigation in June 1904. I recall we had one item, two or three sacks of frosted potatoes in the cellar. One of my first orders from Mr. Turner was that these potatoes were only to be sold in 5-pound lots, and then only to men who had been suffering from scurvy during the winter by reason of impoverished diet. Our principal items of food, which were in fair supply, were a stack of port-costed flour, very lumpy and old, in 100-pound bags, and a dozen or so cases of blue-labeled tomato catsup. And of course there were such staples as some veal beans and a little pastry bacon, some tea and bean coffee, which we ground up in a hand-operated coffee mill when required by a customer. There were no luxuries of any kind available. However, we all made out somehow until the first boats of the season brought us fresh supplies from the outside via Whitehorse and Dawson. Looking back on that time, 50-odd years ago, when I first joined the company, I can only marvel at the immense changes that have taken place in everything, and in particular in the luxuries that we now enjoy in the way of fine foods, etc., compared with the primitive conditions of the pioneer days. In reality, we have come a very long way in raising our standard of living and in all the refinements of daily life. Shortly after I joined the company, Dick Wood left to become a partner with E.T. Barnett when they opened up the Fairbanks Banking Company. Mr. Turner and I looked after the office work then until additional help could be sent in from the home office in San Francisco, which was not until near midsummer. In the meantime, good spring cleanups were being made on the claims on Pedro, Kerry, and Fairbanks Street, where winter dumps had been taken out the previous winter, 1903 and 4, and when news of that got abroad, it started a renewed rush to Fairbanks, which by that fall attained the proportions of a real stampede from all directions by individuals seeking to acquire leases or stake new claims on other creeks in the vicinity. With the arrival of several thousand new people into the camp during the summer and fall of 1904, the company was doing a very brisk business, supplying the new arrivals with complete outfits of supplies so they could carry on mining through the winter. And from that time on, for the next 10 years, Fairbanks and the surrounding creeks teemed with activity. The company staff was considerably augmented in all departments, and a commencement was made on the construction and installation of an electric power plant to supply electricity, steam heat, and water to the town, as the company had been granted a 25-year franchise for these utilities. Among the new members of the staff arriving in the summer of 1904 was Frank H. Grace, who was made cashier and bookkeeper. Grace had previously been a purser on one of the Yukon River boats before being transferred to Fairbanks. I was then given the position as assistant to Grace. Mr. Turner continued in charge as agent at Fairbanks and had the assistance of J.W. Jim Hill, who was sent in from San Francisco during the summer of 1904. Turner was ready and anxious to resign as soon as he could be relieved by the appointment of a successor. He had taken a mining lease on a rich claim in Clary Creek and had as partners the notorious Swiftwater Bill Gates and another man, a Welshman, whose name I cannot now recall. His first name was Phil, I remember that. Turner was anxious to get out on the creek to look after the business end of the partnership. As it eventually happened, Swiftwater Bill was just too swift for Turner's style of doing business, and he was in a short time glad to dispose of his interest in the lease to his partners. And he and Mrs. Turner returned to San Francisco early in the summer of 1905. Wally Richmond was slated to succeed Turner, was agent for the company at Bethel Station, and in March 1905 he made the trip to Fairbanks by a dog team over the winter trail, accompanied by Joe Matthews. Matthews was appointed chief engineer in charge of the power plant and company machine shop. Joe was later, some years later, chief engineer on the Seymour Yukon for AYN Company running between Dawson and Fairbanks. He died at Fort Yukon a number of years ago when on the service of AYN Company. Joe was all wool in the yard wide, which was one of his favorite expressions when describing a man he liked personally. A day or two before the Turners were due to leave the apartment over the store, Richmond decided we should have a goodbye party for the employees, and we all foregathered one evening in the agent's apartment for this purpose with Mr. and Mrs. Turner. Turner had provided some beer by way of refreshment, but Richmond thought beer was too poor and insipid a beverage to use for such an auspicious occasion, and he ordered up some mum's champagne. Very soon the boys were getting in quite a jolly mood, and so, not to alarm or embarrass Mrs. Turner, after a suitable interval we adjourned to the employees' dormitory across the hall from the agent's quarters, so the Turners could retire for the night, and the party was continued until well into the morning, and more champagne was consumed, with Richmond playing the part of generous host. It was my first experience with the bubbly beverage, and while joy was unconfined for several rounds, very soon the weaker members began to drop off one by one, and left the party. And eventually we all separated to seek our own corners to sleep the balance of the night. Richmond himself was careful to partake sparingly of the liquid refreshment, but he apparently enjoyed watching the funny effects it had on some of the boys. And oh, what a headache the next morning. The hidden potency of the champagne, which had at first tasted like a sort of glorified ginger ale, made itself manifest. And old R.E. Morse kept some of us company for most of the following day. Frank Grace, who posed as a sophisticated man of the world, assured us that the correct antidote for our overindulgence was to take a stiff glass of champagne as a morning cup. And he proceeded to demonstrate by opening a bottle that was left over from the party and downing a good glass of it. None of the rest of us, however, had the courage to face it. For the first year or two in Fairbanks, many of the miners paid their accounts with the company in gold dust. And for the winter and spring of 1904 and 5, the greater part of our accounts were paid in dust. And as dust had been taken in trade in Dawson at an established rate of $16 per troy ounce, that rate was used in Fairbanks in estimating the amount of dust needed to pay a bill. There were no safe means of transporting our funds or gold dust to the home office in San Francisco in that first winter of 1904 and 5, and by the opening of navigation in late May, the company had accumulated something over $400,000 in gold dust alone. The dust was put up in native tan caribou hide pokes, each holding 600 ounces. The company safe could not begin to hold our gold, and we were given the use of an iron chest in the vault of the Fairbanks Banking Company, which was close to the store on 2nd Avenue. The office staff got our gold dust packed in strong sealed boxes the night before the first upriver boat was due to sail, and when we retired to our rooms well after midnight, all daylight at that time of year, we left on the office floor 11 boxes of treasure in the shape of gold dust and some 45,000 excess currency, all ready for consignment to San Francisco. We were pleased and surprised when we got final returns on the dust from the San Francisco Mint to find that we had made a gain of slightly over $40,000, as I recall the amount. This came about from the fact that the gold dust from the creeks around Fairbanks was of higher average value than $16 an ounce, the going rate we had used when the dust was received by us. There was no way we could make restitution to the many individuals who had paid us in dust at $16 an ounce, and so the company had carried most of the large operators on credit for 6 months and over without interest, as was the custom in the early days. The gain on this dust could be considered as earned in lieu of interest. As there were three banks operating here by 1906, and they were buying dust at actual assay values, the company never again took in so much gold dust as that first year, although they still handled a fair amount of it each year for several years thereafter, and I believe they still handled it, but they send it out to San Francisco now, and the owner of the dust gets full of value. We had just advanced something on it. In the fall of 1906, Richmond was married to Miss Florence Mayo, who arrived via Dawson from San Francisco. There was low water at that particular time of year in the Chena River, and boat passengers were transferred to Tanana Valley Railway at Chena to finish the journey to Fairbanks. The engineer on the train had been passed the word that Richmond's bride was on the train, and when it was still well below the town, he opened up the whistle wide and kept up the din until the train pulled in through the depot, where practically the whole town was in hand to see the bride. Late in the fall that same year, we had the first tragedy to strike us, when Fred Klein, the company warehouseman and warfager, was drowned off the dock in front of the store during the unloading of a barge of freight, late on a dark night in early part of October. There was always a great rush in the fall in those days to get late-season cargoes landed before the freeze-up caught us, and it was always an anxious time of year for those responsible for the safety of boats and cargo. I can recall the shock we all got when Richmond came into our dormitory the following morning. He himself had been up all night on the dock to tell us that Fred Klein had been drowned in the night. The body was never recovered. Fred was a big, strong, husky six-footer who had previously worked for the company in Dawson and was a member of the volunteer fire brigade there. The next event to record was the wedding of Frank Grace to Miss Rose Chatel, a popular telephone operator, in the summer of 1906. M.L. Washburn, the general manager, was on his annual visit accompanied by W.H. Fairbanks, the superintendent. Washburn had appointed Grace to be agent at Circle Station, and he was to leave the following day for his new post. The union, which we knew was pending, had to be hastily arranged, and the wedding ceremony was held that evening in the agent's apartment with Mr. and Mrs. Washburn among the guests. The wedding and reception that followed was a very quiet and decorous affair. We were served with a cup of punch after the wedding, but in the presence of the big boss, M.L., the reception was somewhat restrained. However, with the connivance of Fairbanks, the superintendent, and Stuart Mendes, the auditor, who was also in Fairbanks at that time, the younger wedding guests moved to the cabin of the then postmaster of Fairbanks. And again, another rather wild night followed. The champagne was again the beverage used, undiluted. We were all happy the next day when the time came for the boat to leave with the Washburns and Grace and his wife, as I knew a few of us felt rather ragged and weary-eyed after the party of the previous evening. Following the departure of Grace to Circle, I was appointed cashier and head bookkeeper, and a little later, Harry Turnbull, another ex-Yukon River boat purser, was appointed as my assistant. Prior to the events recounted above, in April 18, 1906, we got the electrifying news by telegraph of the San Francisco earthquake and fire. The company home office building in California and Sansom Street was destroyed in the fire that followed the earthquake, and the home office was moved temporarily to Oakland. In just 1 month after the earthquake, there occurred the big fire in Fairbanks, which destroyed the entire business section of town between Cushman and Lacey and from 1st to 3rd Avenue. The fire started in a dentist's office on the second floor of a three-story building on the east corner of 1st and Cushman, and was out of control very quickly. As it was all daylight at that time of year, May, the rebuilding of the town started immediately, and as work continued day and night without cessation, the entire burned area was speedily rebuilt. The company property was not touched by the fire, fortunately, and we had a very busy year of it thereafter. In the fall of 1907, Mr. and Mrs. Richmond went out to San Francisco for the winter. Richmond had been ailing the previous winter and was due for a vacation. I was appointed acting agent during his absence and until his return the following spring. At that period came the bank panic in the States, which caused everyone much concern. The panic started in New York in October 1907 and very soon spread throughout the entire country. The bank stopped paying out U.S. currency on checks and issued scrip in suitable denominations, which served as a means of money exchange until the panic subsided early in 1908, when currency payments were resumed. The banks in Fairbanks very shortly followed the course of the banks in the States early that winter. I was on the trustee committees for all three banks. That was Fairbanks Bank, the First National, and the Washington Alaska. In the winter of 19, and along with my fellow trustees, signed the locally printed scrip used here that winter until currency payments were resumed at the same time as the banks in the States, and the last great bank panic passed into history. During that same winter of 1907 and 1908, Jack Healy, the grocery head salesman, got married. As Jack was a very popular individual with the public and had acquaintance with almost everyone, the wedding gifts were both lavish and plentiful. I decided that under the circumstances the company should bear the cost of the wedding reception, which was held in the quarters over the store. At that period we had a close-knit community here, all neighbors and well known to each other, and everyone who could come was invited to the reception. Our own gang of the boys were on hand to give assistance with the guests. We again used champagne for the refreshment of the guests in liberal quantity, and we certainly had a wedding reception the like of which never has been held in Fairbanks before or since. The principals in that wedding party have now left the Saturday scene, and most of the jolly crowd of guests who helped celebrate have also joined the great majority in the half century that have passed since the event recorded here. In midsummer 1908, Mrs. Richmond's younger sister, Miss Kathleen A. Miro, came over from Bethel's to visit with the Richmonds. Kathleen had spent the previous 2 years after leaving high school on a visit with her uncle and aunt, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Grimm at Bethel's, where Grimm had been company agent from the time of Richmond's transfer to Fairbanks in 1905. The Grimms were leaving Alaska that fall, 1908, to make their home in San Francisco, and on their way to the States they came over for a short visit in Fairbanks for a week or two. When the Grimms left Fairbanks, their niece Kathleen traveled with them on the way back to San Francisco, as they had previously arranged to do. The following year I was granted leave of absence, the first vacation in 5 years, in order to visit my mother and others of the family, my brother and sister, who were still living in Scotland. I had been gone from my home in Scotland 10 years by that time. I travelled out from Alaska with the Lower Yukon route via St. Michael and Nome on the SS Umatilla. I visited California then for the first time and had the opportunity to meet the various members of the Home Office staff, most of whom I had known only by name before that time. I also at that time took a very important step, as I forsook that so-called state of single blessedness and was married to Kathleen Miro, who was then living with her maternal grandparents in Napa and employed in her uncle's office there. So I was able to carry her proudly back to Scotland as my wife. That was my last visit to my native land. We both still had many happy memories of that year before the horror of World War I broke on the world. Before we finally left Scotland, we made a tour through Ireland, England, France, including the Riviera and Monte Carlo, then Italy, Switzerland, and back to Scotland, and then back to the States in the late spring and home to Fairbanks early in June 1910. Germany declared war on Russia August 1st, 1914, which started the war, which was soon to envelop the principal nations of Europe and eventually the whole world. The war did not disturb our life in Alaska to any great degree, although the flames of war did draw some few of our venturesome spirits among the younger men, some of whom never returned. The conflict in that war was mostly confined to the other side of the world and was in some ways very remote from Alaska. Business became rather quiet, in fact, in all lines, and gold mining, our chief industry, went into the doldrums, so to speak. About this time, however, the first survey parties were in the field surveying for the projected Alaska Railroad. 9 years later, the railroad was completed and through service established from Seward to Fairbanks. It was officially opened by President Harding at a ceremony in Indiana in July 1923. Richmond was appointed superintendent of the company in 1911-1912, and the family took up residence in San Francisco. George A. Coleman, who had been manager of the hardware department for several years, was appointed agent at Fairbanks, a successor to Richmond. In the fall of 1915, I went down to San Francisco on vacation, accompanied by my wife and our two children, Charles and Janet. We traveled by way of Dawson on steamer Yukon in late September on our way to California. At that time, the war in Europe was being bitterly contested on the Western Front, although the United States had not yet been drawn into the conflict. In the early part of 1916, we were visiting in Fort Bragg, Northern California, with my wife's parents. And as that was the days of, before the days of radio broadcasting, I had to wait eagerly each day for the arrival of newspapers from San Francisco to get the latest war news, in which I was intensely interested, as my relatives in Scotland were close to the war and some of the younger members at the fighting front. During that, this time, occurred the dastardly bomb outrage on Lower Market Street, San Francisco, during a Preparedness Day parade. When I got my paper in Fort Bragg the following afternoon, I was shocked to read that among the 7 or 8 innocent bystanders who were killed by the bomb was my old associate in Fairbanks of 10 years before, Harry Turnbull. Harry was working on the ferry building, and it was Saturday afternoon. He was on his way home, stopped right at the spot where the bomb was concealed in a trunk, I think it was, a suitcase. Harry was given a military funeral and was buried at the Presidio, as he was a veteran of the Spanish-American War. In late March 1916, Richmond accompanied me on the way north from his annual inspection of the company stations. We went north to Cordova on the old SS Northwestern, and while en route to Fairbanks, the way of Chittenden, we took inventory of all stage line property, as the company was then preparing to close up the stage line. The company had been underbid for the final mail contract over the route before the new railroad was ready to carry the mail. The man who got the contract made a sorry mess of the job and quit a loser after only 2 years of operation, and the railroad was forced to take over the mail contract, although they were then only in course of construction. Early in October 1918, we experienced a period of tragedy, which affected many of us here in Alaska and also Yukon Territory. In the first week of the month, George Coleman, that's the manager of Fairbanks, was drowned on a launch traveling from Nenana to Fairbanks. The fast-covered launch flyer hit a snag in the Tanana River, coming up river, on a cold, raw, sleety day, and the 8 or 9 people in the launch were drowned. At that time, many of our local friends and acquaintances were waiting in Fairbanks to go out on the steamer Yukon on our last trip of the season upriver to Whitehorse, connecting with the CPR boat at Skagway. Several of these people spoke to me regarding the loss of the launch and expressed their sorrow for the loss of life, all of them people well known here. They themselves were on the way to a far greater tragedy, and they were all among the passengers of SS Princess Sophia, which was sunk shortly after leaving Skagway with complete loss of all on board. Among the victims were the entire crew of the river steamer Yukon, also on their way outside. As the town people gathered in the corner saloon at First and Cushman, the night the news of the Sophia disaster came in, there was shock and dismay on the faces of everyone, as successive bulletins were received with additional lists of victims. It was the worst sea disaster in Alaska history. I had by that time been appointed agent at Fairbanks after George Coleman was drowned. In less than a month after the Sophia disaster, the joyful news of the armistice of November 11th was received in town and served to give us all a riotously happy reaction to the local tragedies immediately preceding the end of the war. Near the close of the winter of 1920, the great flu epidemic, which had done so much deadly havoc in Europe and the rest of the world in the closing years of the war, finally reached Fairbanks. This was another time of trial for the entire region, and there were a number of deaths among the younger people, both in Fairbanks and Nenana. The Nenana agent of the NC Company and his assistant both died within a day of each other, and the Nenana store had to be supplied with temporary staff from Fairbanks. During 1921, the heads of the old company had decided to close out their business in Alaska and Yukon Territory as soon as it could be satisfactorily effected. Mr. Richmond, then superintendent in San Francisco, was able to form a new corporation to take over the stores, stocks, riverboats, and all other property of the old company. And the new corporation commenced operations in 1922, with Richmond as president of the company. The home office was then moved from San Francisco to Seattle. The agents of the new company assumed the title of manager, thus superseding the old Pioneer Trading Company title of agent. Business generally throughout the whole country took some years to make a good recovery from the after effects of the war, and the business depression which hit the states in 1929 and business in Alaska more or less followed the same ups and downs as the rest of the country. The company continued to make progress slowly in a fast-changing world and eventually acquired the new station at Anchorage, now the largest store in the entire chain, and also extended operations in Alaska to Juneau and as far south as Ketchikan. That was the substance of my paper, and I hope there's been enough historical interest in it to be worthy of entry among your chronicles.
Well, thank you, George. I know that there are some of us that remember that word for word, day by day, in fact. And you can be very sure that'll be one of the most valuable portions of the records of the Historical Society. And I trust that you don't feel overly provoked at us now for having had your leg pulled and your arm twisted to get you out.
Any interest out of it. Satisfaction to me.
Well, that's just wonderful, George. It's all right. No, there's a great... Well, thank you very much. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the part of Jack Healy's reception, because that was one of the highlights of my young life.
The other one that you missed was Frank Gordon. The only one you missed was Frank Gordon. I thought it was another one.
Well, how about the Bobby? How about the boy that was the manager of the hardware store? Married the Goose girl. Doris Goose. What was his name?
Who?
The manager of the NC Hardware Store?
George Marcus.
Yeah. He was the one that put on the reception to end all receptions. His wife was on the Sophia, Doris Goose.
He was 330.
I know that whole contingent of boys from Fairbanks just missed it. No, I came to Alaska just about 2 months after the Islander went down.
The Islander was 1900.
Yeah, 1900. Oh, I don't believe so.
1918, just before the war.
Of the war. Yeah, they're still sending men out from Alaska when that happened. Did we have anything further? Amongst the notes that Audrey left was that I was to appoint committees, and as I said at the beginning of the meeting, I'll just have to give that some consideration, and before the next meeting is called, those committees will be appointed. Does anyone else have anything to offer at this time? Any?
I would like a petition for the use of para-rapid tape in research in the trial of magazine article.
Well, I'm going to appoint a committee, and this is the way the committee will be appointed, I hope. That we'll appoint one member from the
Historical Society, and we will, I'm a member of the Pioneers, an officer in the Pioneers, and we'll get one member from the Pioneers, and then we will get a third member. Now, who or what that third member will be, where that'll be drawn from, I don't know. They will pass on the loaning of the tapes, who they're to be loaned to, and for what length of time they will be loaned. And there will have to be some pretty strict safeguards put on the use of those tapes. In this respect, a tape can very easily be erased just by improper use. You would know that as well. So it would, yeah. So it's going to take a lot of consideration on the part of the committee to be sure that those tapes get in the hands of people that do know how to handle a tape. But just by the flick of a switch, why this entire talk of George's could be erased, or Bob Bloom's of past meetings could be erased, and it's gone forever. So before the next meeting, why that committee will be appointed, and if you will make your mark, it will be known, and I'm sure that we'd be very happy to see you at the table. Is there any?
Every meeting, when I come to meeting, I usually bring a couple of logs and documents or something, you know, to be identified. And I little things I've got over there, I can
What is it that you have?
Well, I got I got Northern Commercial book here. And I got the bills of the Northern Commercial around 1921.
Are they paid?
I don't know. And then I got a picture of a man here. I don't know who he is. I want to be identified. Then I want to know something about Egan and Griffin.
Oh, boy. You get lots of that.
And A.J. McLean. And I got the life insurance policy of Egan and Griffin. And the power of attorney of McLean, the quick claim deed of, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, between Griffin and Grill.
Yeah, they just whose records have you been delving into there? Golly, that's...
Oh, certainly, yeah. I hope I got a question about 99 documents. I got some over at Clary, some over at Gulf, some over at Chattanooga, some over at Fairbanks Creek, and now I'm working with Goldstein there.
That's a boy to tie into there. Well, Goldstream was a very interesting stream when it started, and there sure was a tremendous amount of activity out there. And
I got some of my material from a man named, I can't think of his first name, his last name is Miller. He lives up there at Big Elder Rock, in an old sort of a roadhouse. And then he's been getting some things, also got something from the society, forging pits, and these portable forging pits with sand, and more. He's given that to the society. Burn up something. And then he gave me a monkey wrench. He said it was made before his time.
Well, I tell you, after we close the meeting and we get milling around with our coffee, why I knew the Egan and Griffin outfit, and Bob Bloom would know them very, very well, and George also. And I don't know, is that the Miller brothers or not? The committee that we will appoint on the tapes will have it within their purview to have that done if they can. But what I have heard Well, I can learn from the people who've had a lot to do with tapes and that are typists say that that's one of the most difficult things imaginable, is to take the ordinary type of tape and transfer that to a typewritten page. It's just a terrific chore. It's not the same as taking from a dictaphone or dictating tape. So I don't know, but that'll be up to the committee that I appoint to look into that. And if they can get it on paper, why then it'll be a very easy matter to thermofax them or what have you, and put them in the hands of people that want to put it to good use. That's right.
Yeah, comment on that tape. I recorded 4 days at the Grand Eagle at Seward, and Lois Erickson, he is able to type directly from the tape certain portions of that right now she's working on. But everybody don't have that ability. And
right.
I had to get a special recorder that she reads over and backstop it, or stop it and return it, and start it again. Just touch with her fingers. This time won't do it.
Yeah.
It's got to be made for that use.
Well, that's just exactly it.
And there's another thing I would like to suggest, that these tapes that we take for the pioneers and for the Historical Society be termed as negatives, and anyone wishing tapes off of them or being authorized to have tapes, they be transferred off of the negative and preserve our negatives intact without anybody else handling them.
That'll be part of it too.
That's one way to preserve. And an individual being taped, if they're still alive, we should have their authorization if the tape used for any other purpose except the pioneers.
Well, that's
right.
I wouldn't.
Well, these people trust me, and I told them I'm going to stick by my word.
Well, I believe this, Harry, that unless this is disproved at a later date, that anything that is any address that is given to the before the Historical Society, and I'm sure that it holds in the pioneers, becomes the property of the pioneers. And becomes, and I would imagine, unless I'm proved wrong, that any address, any talk that is given before the Historical Society becomes the property of the Historical Society.
Correct. That's the way it should.
And for temporary purposes, why, you are the custodians of the tape, but they are the property of the Historical Society or the pioneers.
That's very clear.
And when the time comes, why, it will be your duty to turn them over to the respective organization,
right.
For what use they did. That's the purpose of the organization, and it's the purpose of purchasing the machines and the tapes. There's one thing that I learned this evening, that both the Historical Society and the pioneers owe you.
Without the original getting transcripts, all the speeches and talks that came from the Historical Society should become the property of the pioneers
or the Historical Society. If you make it before the Historical Society, why, it'd be the property of the Historical Society.
Well, do they get all the records out of this machine that you copied here and every speech that's made, or is that the property distinctly for the Historical Society?
That's distinctly for the Historical Society.
And then there are two different units.
That's right. Not on anything that goes on here. Oh, no. No, that's what I said. That you have the two different organizations.
Now, there's another thing, then. That's to take the machine, or whatever you call the record, that's to be preserved exclusively for the Historical Society.
That's right. But it was the intent, and it's written into the original papers of the Historical Society, that the papers, talks, materials, at some time when proper custody can be assumed, will be turned over to responsible people to write articles on it, make pictures on it, make talks on it, or what have you.
Well, if you take the reading why I say so, or you take the speech that Mr. Preston gave here tonight, it's a very valuable one.
That's right.
And therefore, you see, it should be just exclusively for the Historical Society. And anybody that wants to go and copy that part of the speech, make a book out of it, why, that's just.
Well, that's got to be thrashed out then on an altogether different level than we have talked on before.
Well,
if you or Mr. Preston wants to copyright it,
well, that's his.
Then it can be done.
Property. What I mean to say is this: some person in later years of time, some man who is just a journalist, will say, and will come around and will copy a few things that we've seen and make a book out of it. But you never mentioned that it was taken out of the Historical Society that was delivered by Mr. Preston.
Oh, no, that's... No.
Bob,
I don't believe that you're giving us credit for...
I'm not giving you all the credit.
No, wait a minute. You're not giving us enough credit for what we
to know and want to do about this. Because nothing that goes out of here that is taken from the Historical Society's archives is going to be allowed without proper credit to the Historical Society. Now, you can be assured of that.
Well, that's what I didn't mean for myself, Preston, or anything.
Well, it goes for anybody. You or Preston or myself or anybody else that makes a talk. But it's not our object to gather all of these speeches, addresses, history, and bury it. They are to be used just as widely as we possibly can, with due credit to the Historical Society and the person. Is that right, George?
Yeah, that's right. I think that probably answers it. But these people that we go to get tapes from, old timers around town, some of them will not talk for the simple reason that somebody has been around trying to get a tape from them for commercial purposes.
Well, we can't help that.
Well, we can't help that, but we can protect the people that will give us those tapes and those stories to make sure they don't fall into the wrong hands. Because some of these people won't talk just for that reason.
Well, we...
I run into them all the time.
I certainly, as long as I have anything to do with it, only say this, I can't obligate the Historical Society or protect the person from someone that is trying to get a tape from.
No.
The only thing that we can do is guarantee that the Historical Society itself will keep a true record of what they say and make a true copy of it if it is typed, and that if it is used for publicity, as the person wants to borrow a tape or a typewritten copy to write a book, that the Historical Society and the person making the address or where the material came from will be given full credit. That's all we can do.
Well, we have two gentlemen here tonight. We have a grand trustee, not yet inducted, and a trustee of even before. And I've had a hard time getting a tape from them of any kind. I would like to get their story, and I know they know the story. Now, if we can get them up here one of these nights and talking, I'd sure be glad to record them.
Well, I think that before we get too involved on this, let us get this committee on recordings, or whatever name we give it. Maybe that between the three of them, possibly you'd be on it, I don't know. With the assistance of a club, we can get this. I imagine you're speaking for Frank, so
one of them. Well, here you are, I'm Mr. Ted
Lawson. Well,
and we do have four recordings now.
Ted is always delighted to make a recording.
I'm looking for Jonas,
but the pioneers have a recorder, and you folks have a recorder, and Paul Brandon purchased one, and I purchased a spare, so if one breaks down, we've always got one we can get our hands on.
I have one, too.
Oh, you have one also.
You get lots of tapes.
Well, there was a little excitement here one time. We couldn't get any. It was not available. None would work.
This is what this loaning of the tapes is one of these are all notes of Audrey from her experience as president during my absence gathered. Now there's a note here on the identifying of museum pictures. I think that is primarily an endeavor of the pioneers of the Igloo number 4, the pioneers. And we will try to arrange for days and times to pick up a few of the old timers in there and bring them out here to the museum and to identify pictures and names. And Mr. Kime is not here tonight, so we can have no report from him. And if there's nothing further of a business nature to come before the group, if there is, why speak up? If not, why? Do you have anything for us?
No, I don't know. I think we should take care of.
I believe I can smell the coffee.
I heard that Mark is already
here. Okay. Well, I'll declare this meeting.
Just a moment, Mark.
Okay, Ted?
Frank was talking to me the other day about a pretty good idea.